Good afternoon. So last time we talked about asymmetric cryptography. So we had these ways of giving us confidentialities or secrecy and authenticity, knowing where messages came from, based on having some shared secret data. And that created a difficulty that, well, we need to securely communicate with the exact person we want to communicate with in advance in order to securely communicate with them later. And that's less practical than we like. And fortunately, through some fancy math, we have a slightly better situation. And that was this notion of sort of public key or asymmetric cryptography, where we can produce a key pair with a private key that someone who wants to receive secret messages or send authenticated messages generates and keeps private to themselves, and a corresponding public key that's linked to that private key and can be given to everyone. And that public key allows anyone to encrypt, so the private key can decrypt, but no one else can decrypt. And the public key allows anyone to verify signatures that are produced using only the private key. So this simplified our problem of how do I arrange secure communications with someone, because they could broadcast this public key to everyone. We don't need to have a separate conversation that's arranged securely somehow for each party we're communicating with, which is really good for like the internet, where we have, you know, billions of web browsers and millions of websites, and that's too many conversations to have. But it's still pretty bad. So we have this solution of certificates, where the idea would be, well, my web browser can't sort of securely get the public keys for absolutely every website out there. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to securely get the public keys for a smaller number of certificate authorities, and those certificate authorities are going to verify on our behalf the public keys of individual websites. And they'll write a certificate that we can verify without talking to them again. We just say, oh, they really verified it using a digital signature. We'll know that it actually comes from them. Yes?
The concept of like public versus private keys, that's just asymmetric encryption, right? Not symmetric?
Question, the concept of public versus private key, that's just asymmetric encryption. So this occurred in both asymmetric encryption and in digital signatures. So we have some sort of public operation that can be done with the public key that everyone is allowed to do, and a private operation that can only be done in the private key that's usually somehow an inverse of that. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. I'd like to also revisit something you talked about two times ago about encryption versus authentication and sort of how they relate, since there was some confusion on this, and understandably so, because I'm being kind of informal here in a way that can get me in trouble for people who are like taking the real cryptography theory class that doesn't have many people signed up for it, but if you want to take cryptography theory, we offer that course about once a year as a special topics. We talked about encryption for confidentiality and message authentication codes for authenticity. And commonly you'll see something that combines these, and when they're being explicit about it, like a library or a program will tell you it provides authenticated encryption. And that generally is produced using a combination of some encryption that is malleable, meaning that if we just did the encryption, some attacker could manipulate the encrypted data and we wouldn't know, along with a message authentication code. And sometimes this is just called encryption, because when you're doing encryption, usually this is actually what you want. Now you might say, why didn't I just teach it that way? Well, that's because if you pick up a library to do encryption for your software product, it's probably gonna do the bad type of encryption, the one that's malleable, and you'll need to do extra work to make it not be tampered with. And somewhat confusingly in the crypto theory area, you might say, oh, confidentiality and authenticity, these sound like nice mathematical terms that we could define. The crypto theory people don't define these terms. They use different sort of notions that are easier to prove things about. So the crypto theory people will talk about things like indistinguishability under chosen plaintext attack, because that's more specific, and they have notions that kind of overlap with both keeping things secret and knowing things weren't tampered with in this space. Okay. So questions about confidentiality versus authenticity? Okay. And when we left off last time, we were talking about some practicalities of certificate authority. So one thing you mentioned is that often we have these chains of certificates that my web browser doesn't actually get a certificate signed, you know, directly by the certificate authority. Often it gets one signed by a certificate authority that it needs another certificate to identify that gets to someone it knows. We have these chains of certificates. One reason this is done is that it allows us to, for example, get a certificate signed by someone who's not on our list of trusted authorities yet and have one certificate authority delegate to another. Another reason it's done is that even when the same entity is operating these two different certificate authorities, the way that often will work is one of them will be offline and one of them will be online, which means if the online one is compromised, they have something they can do about it to maybe recover from that without replacing absolutely everything. And another piece of practicality I mentioned is, well, you know, if they're supposed to write these certificates that tell us, oh, this is really Google.com's public key, or this is really Colab's or Canvas's public key, you know, how do they do that? And we learned that, well, it's not actually as amazing as you might think in practice. So for the web public key infrastructure, the browsers and the certificate authorities basically have an industry group that writes the rules that the web browsers say need to be followed. And if you don't follow the rules, the web browsers won't add you to their lists. And these rules are called the baseline requirements. And they allow these, you know, maybe kind of sketchy ways of validating domains where, like, you send an email to the official domain contact or you look up the web page insecurely and make sure it matches what you expect. So they're not doing something magical. You might think this is attackable, and it is. And they probably do things that you mitigate, like high priority attacks. So for example, if you're trying, you know, they'll probably ask for some extra steps if you're saying, I want a certificate for Google.com. It probably will be a little harder. There are some other things they do that are maybe more useful for this. So one thing that certificate authorities do is they have a database of revoked certificates. So there's theoretically a way that if they mess up in giving a certificate, or you get a certificate and you realize, oh, that public key is no good anymore because, like, I lost the private key and someone who I don't want to have it has it, they can revoke it. And there's a list that browsers can check, and occasionally they do, often they don't. There's also something called certificate transparency. So over the past several years, all the browsers have started requiring all certificate authorities to have a public log of every single website certificate that has been issued. And browsers enforce that certificates are in that log, so if they don't put them in the log, the certificate won't work in the browser. And the idea of this is that if you're a website author, if someone fools a certificate authority to issue a certificate for your website, you can at least find out about it by monitoring these logs. And another thing they support is that you can specify in DNS that I only want this certificate authority to issue certificates for my domains, and all certificate authorities are supposed to respect that. So you know, that if you don't trust anyone but, you know, Sectigo, you can say, no one else issues certificates for my domain. You know, and that sort of mitigates a lot of the sort of worry you might have about attacks on that. So questions, these few other things the grid authorities are supposed to do. Okay, so we're gonna talk about a few additional cryptographic tools that are kind of miscellaneous. Like I started with encryption and authentication or digital signatures because those are kind of the most obviously useful for secure communication. We're gonna have a few other things we're gonna talk about. So start with cryptographic hash functions. And these are a thing that comes up a lot. And kind of one obvious motivation for this comes with digital signatures. So I prefer digital signatures are that we have a sign function that takes a private key and a message and produces a signature. But usually kind of the raw version of this has a limit on the size of the message, that you can only sign something that's so big. So if you want to use digital signatures to sign something that's larger than that, you want to kind of summarize what you're signing in a way where that summary is secure in the sense that like it can't be interpreted in the way you don't intend. And cryptographic hashes are a tool for doing this kind of summarization. So they're a hash function, which means they take a lot of values and map them to a small number of values, but they're cryptographic because they have some security in that, unlike a typical hash function used for a hash table, they're designed to resist sort of attacks where someone could have one hash mapped to different things that are useful. So basically what this will give us is that we'll have a hash function where we take a hash of some message m and we get a value x, and there will be two like big properties. So one is what we'll call collision resistance, that it's going to be really hard to find anything else that has the hash x. How this is achievable is that usually x is pretty long, you know, not super long, but like if it's 256 bits, that's enough to make it so, like, if you just try, you'd have to try 2 to the 256-ish values of m to get something that matches. And also, it should be pretty hard to, like, find a second value that hashes to the same thing, even if you know a first thing that hashes to it. So the hashes, in some sense, you know, can stand in for the original m, because even though, yes, there are other things that hash to x, they're really hard to find and just impractical to find. So I mentioned that sort of one use of this is that when those digital signature algorithms only let us sign something short, we can use this to substitute for a really long message. Another use of these cryptographic hashes is that one of the most common ways of constructing message authentication codes uses these as kind of the building block. Questions about cryptographic hashes? Okay. So some of you who are familiar with cryptographic hashes in practice might be wondering why I didn't mention another, you know, common use of hash functions in security, which is for password storage. And I did that because, you know, I want to talk about that specially, because that is a common task, and it's something where the normal cryptographic hashes actually are missing a property we really want. So it's very common that we'll use a cryptographic hash to store passwords, with the idea being that if someone recovers the hash because of this first property here, you know, or sorry, it's going to be hard to actually reverse the hash. Like it should be really hard to go from a message, from a hash to the original message. And that's really good because that means that if I'm using this method to store passwords and someone gets my database of passwords, they only have these useless hashes that they can't reverse back into the passwords part. But this prevents them from like computing from the hash the password. It doesn't prevent them from checking a lot of passwords and seeing if the hash matches. And a big problem is that the number of plausible passwords is usually pretty small. So if our cryptographic hash function is quick, then they can check a lot of passwords that are potential passwords really fast. And our cryptographic hash function being quick is often something that we really want. If we're doing those digital signatures, we want to sign things really fast. If we're doing message authentication codes, we want to produce those really fast. But it's a very bad property for password hashing. So instead, if you're doing password hashing, there are kind of specialized, resource-intensive cryptographic hash functions that are designed to control the speed of the hash function. And I have some examples mentioned on the slide. So argon2i, or scrypt, or pbkdf2 are some examples that are just specialized cryptographic hash functions that have this extra property that they're designed to slow down the hash function deliberately so attackers who try to guess lots of inputs take a longer time. And that's important with passwords because with passwords, the number of inputs they have to guess isn't very big. With something like using it for a digital signature, you know, the number of inputs they'd have to guess to have something that, you know, matches the same hash is going to be very high. But because it has to, because what they're looking for is like getting the same hash with a different message than the actual original one. So questions? Cryptographic and password hashing. Okay, and one other tool that I've kind of glossed over is random numbers. So as I said, we generate a key, a private key or a shared key, and we need no one else to know. So how do we do that? And if you want, the most common way is that we say we choose a random number. So the question is, like, what does that actually mean in practice? How do we have a computer choose a random number? And we want a random number that sort of not just seems like it varies. We want it to be hard for an attacker to actually guess it. It's important that an attacker who, you know, knows what's going on can't guess it. And this requires something that sort of isn't just things our machines naturally do generally, because if we think of like executing instructions, that's all deterministic. If an attacker knows what program we're running, they know the numbers it can output. And usually there's not that many of them if we don't have something else going on. We also wanted to have it very important that if we like know the prior numbers, we shouldn't know the later ones. So how do we actually generate these numbers, sort of these unpredictable for an attacker numbers? So what are some things we can do that? Yeah?
Stuff with primes.
Stuff with primes. So the problem there, that's not going to be enough by itself because we need the attacker not to know what numbers we're using. Right? Just doing primes not going to help us with that. Yeah? So values about a user's current state, like any ideas, anyone?
MAC address, the current time, like the oxygen level.
So MAC address, that attacker can probably figure that out. Current time, a little better. Attacker can guess that, but maybe not very precisely. Sensors like oxygen level, or more realistically, most computers like have a temperature sensor that's predictable, but is it probably not super predictable to like the last digit of it? Any other Yes, yeah.
The boot time.
What?
The time to boot.
The boot time, so that's, so that probably the attacker doesn't know all of that, but the attacker probably guess a lot of it. Yeah. Yeah? Lavalex, so we can use, yeah, we can use things that are sort of physically random, yeah?
I don't know if it's like efficient, but you could like create random race conditions.
So we can create random race conditions, so we can look at timing of things that seem non-deterministic. And the question is like, are those really random? And well, some of them are, some of them aren't, right? So that sort of timing and also sort of inputs from sensors, like a bunch of these things are used in practice for random. So the most common source is kind of timing. And the reason why that makes sense is that the exact timing depends on a lot of things, like exactly when packets come in from the network and when things come in off the disk, which is dependent on hardware and a somewhat, you know, very hard to predict even for someone who knows exactly what we're running way. We can also imagine physical sensors that help us, and some processors have kind of a built-in dedicated circuit that's designed to produce randomness using some physical phenomenon that's kind of, you know, seems non-deterministic in some physical, like electrical way. But we have basically these sources of things, like times and intervals of I/O that we think are hard for attackers to figure out, and we put them together and combine them in some way to get random bytes. That's sort of what most machines end up doing. And hopefully we have enough of these that the attacker is not going to be able to predict our random numbers. If we don't, well, the attacker can figure out all the inputs close enough and like figure out what the possible random numbers are. And I'm saying have enough of these because there's many things that are fine kind of, you know, sources of randomness, but wouldn't be enough by themselves. For example, like the exact nanosecond something happens, like probably an attacker can't predict that, but they can probably limit it down to like a million possibilities if they know what the thing is. They can try a million numbers, usually. Questions? This idea of looking entropy. Yes?
What do you mean by entropy in this case?
What I mean by entropy? I mean kind of thing, information the attacker can't predict. And entropy is usually the term, formally or informally, you'll see used in libraries for doing this or OS code for doing this. Other questions? Okay.
Direction.
Yeah.
Like, how would the hacker or whatever, like, if you did something obvious, like a MAC address, would he just, like, guess and check the common things? Like, how would he know?
So let's say I decided to use a MAC address, which I mentioned was not a very good source. How would the attacker know? So with MAC addresses, if you look them up, it turns out they're assigned by manufacturers and blocks. So the attacker could probably guess, oh, you have a network card from one of these five manufacturers. There are 50 million possibilities. And I know you generated, say, a private key from it. So I'm going to generate 50 million private keys, try each one until one works.
With that and prime numbers and whatever.
So we want other sources of sort of usually environmental things, yeah, to complement that. And I guess there's been some real examples. I should know where the story. There's like a story of an online casino who used like microsecond time as a random seed, and that turned out to be, or nanosecond time, but it turned out not to have enough entropy, so someone could figure out, oh, that's how all the shuffling is being done. Which obviously didn't work out for them. Yeah. How do you confirm that the password is correct? So this is separate from the hashing discussion. So this is like, I need to get keys for things. Yeah, so this is complete, I did passing and this. This is like two miscellaneous topics. Other questions? Okay, and now I'm gonna get to our final miscellaneous topic. And this is gonna be constructing kind of our overall view of doing secure communication. We're talking about how TLS, that's the protocol used to encrypt like browser communications, works at a very high level. And to talk about that, I need to talk about kind of two things that TLS does that don't immediately make sense. So one is that TLS uses both asymmetric and symmetric encryption, or asymmetric cryptography and asymmetric encryption. And you might say, why would you do that? Wouldn't just asymmetric be enough? Absolutely. And the reason why is speed. That symmetric cryptography is much faster. So asymmetric cryptography, like for encrypting like a couple kilobytes, is like on the order of, you know, hundreds of microseconds. Symmetric cryptography for encrypting a couple of kilobytes is on the order of 1 microsecond or less, or maybe well less than 1 microsecond. And symmetric cryptography is also much, much better at dealing with large messages. So for this reason, pretty much any way you'll see of doing secure communication that uses asymmetric cryptography will also use symmetric cryptography, but kind of bootstrapped by asymmetric cryptography. Yeah. Question, is the big O runtime different? No. But the big difference is that basically, if you think of what public keys are doing, like it's a lot more mathematically magical, right? It's a lot weirder that you can have this public key that can do an operation in one way and not the other. But there is a way to do it in the opposite way, right? It's not actually reversible. Versus symmetric operations don't need this. So it turns out just the math is a lot simpler for symmetric cryptography that is believed to be secure. Yeah?
You were saying TLS or something?
TLS. For transport layer security. Yeah, we'll have it on slides later. So another weird thing that TLS does is in the most common mode of operation, it uses a different asymmetric thing than either encryption or digital signatures that I'll call a key agreement protocol. So this seems weird because we can do what this protocol is going to do with normal encryption, normal public key encryption. So basically, we're going to have a scenario where my browser has the web server, B in this case, you know, public key. And we want to choose a shared secret. Why do we want a shared secret? Because we're gonna do symmetric cryptography. We want to share keys for symmetric encryption and message authentication. And we can do this with normal public key encryption. Basically, we have one party choose a key, send it to the other. That can solve this problem. We're gonna have this alternate model, which is what TLS uses, where we have a different type of tool for asymmetric sort of key agreement, where we're gonna have this mathematical tool where we can generate these private values, which are basically sort of private keys, and generate a corresponding public key. And there's a way of combining our public key with someone else's private key to get a value, and they can combine our public value with their private value to get the same number. And that's how we're gonna agree on a key. So this is a different asymmetric tool, and it is the most common one that actually is used by sort of web browsers when you're connecting to a website securely. And so the way it works is that we choose that if A and B want to agree on a shared secret, like some keys, that A chooses a random value, which we'll say is kind of like a private key, and they send a public value derived from it, which is kind of like a public key, but if you look up documentation on this, will be called a key share. And B does the same thing, and then A combines their private value with B's key share to get a number. B combines their private value with A's key share to get a number, and they both get the same number because the math is set up so that it works that way. And kind of like our asymmetric encryption, this is going to be set up so if you don't have one of the two private values, you have no way of getting that same number. And this is kind of a very abstract view of sort of Diffie-Hellman-based key agreement. You can look up the actual number theory math, but there's a number of protocols that kind of work in this way. Yes?
How can you set up the math to make them get the same number?
Question, how can we set up the math so they get the same number? So basically what we're doing is we're choosing a function that has this property. And that's going to be how we get our public value and our private value. So we're going to choose an x that doesn't matter, but we just need to have a function which has this property where kind of we get the same value when we apply the function multiple times, no matter the order we do it. And to be concrete, an example of a function that has this property is f of xy is some g to the xy mod some prime. There's one possible function that can do this.
And this way, y is bad enough, it doesn't matter?
This way, y is value. So when we do the sort of overall combination in any indirect order with this function, we end up getting g to the x to the y, the z, basically, right? And because of commutativity, like, it doesn't matter the order we do it in. Yeah, so we're not going to test on that math. Like, the abstract view is that we can get a key share in our private value and combine it, and the other party can do the same with our key share and their private value, and they get the same number. But yeah, that's how it's possible mathematically. You know, it sort of looks like that kind of exponentiation idea, usually. I'm being vague on the exact math because, like, this is a way of doing it, but it's not actually what's done, because to do it in this way, you need to have, to do it securely in this way, like, the values of y need to be pretty big. And it turns out there's a way of making it so the values can be much smaller, but the math is not something I want to explain in this class. Yeah?
So, like, I guess if you can't already do it asymmetrically encrypted, why does it have to be, like, set up like this?
So why are they doing this setup if we have asymmetric encryption? So
I know symmetric would be faster, and they want to set up shared secret, but, like, can a shared secret?
So wouldn't it be easier to use asymmetric encryption is basically your question. And we can absolutely use asymmetric encryption, and it's kind of simpler. I would say, like, the actual amount of sort of computational work you're doing ends up being similar, because this sort of math is actually similar to how some asymmetric encryption works internally. We're kind of just skipping some extra steps by just taking this result kind of directly. That we're in asymmetric encryption, we'd actually do some extra work for some schemes. The other reason is that a property that TLS is going to want is that if you intercept, if you get keys for connections now, that doesn't help you later. Something known as forward secrecy, that each connection kind of has its own keys. And this kind of gives the property naturally if we choose a new random number for each connection. And that's probably the main reason that this is adopted over the kind of the more natural scheme of generating a key and sending it encrypted. Does that answer your question?
And by encrypted, do you mean using
Sort of by the idea of generating a key and sending encryption, I mean, yeah, generating a key and using public key encryption to send it, which is another scheme that TLS has used in the past, but is not very common today. Yeah?
So it's like, because generating key pairs takes a while sometimes, like to generate secure key pairs, so this is just a faster way.
Question, generating secure key pairs takes a while. So here we're kind of generating key pairs, but this turns out to be pretty fast. Some of the schemes that are more commonly used for asymmetric encryption are signatures, like RSA. Generating key pairs is actually pretty slow, which is another reason this has been chosen. Okay. So I'm telling you about this, that it's used, and there's some sort of performance reasons for it, but there's nothing inherently saying you have to do this instead of building it on top of asymmetric encryption. But now that we know that, we can talk about how TLS works in its most common mode of operation. So TLS, this is transport layer security, is the name. This is the most common protocol that's really an application layer protocol, but that other application layer protocols are built atop that implements kind of website security. A naming thing I should mention is that this is this is basically the same as SSL. You'll sometimes see the term SSL used. That's not the term used in the standard anymore, but this protocol is basically the latest version of SSL, which you may have heard of also, for secure sockets layer. And here I'm showing the messages sent back and forth. I'm giving sort of kind of the name of the message. If you look up the protocol specification, they'll say there's a client hello message you can send and it contains these things. We're not going to talk about all the exact things it contains. But the most common way the protocol works in sort of modern browsers, not the only way it can work. It turns out there are like 50 different ways it can work. Just one reason browser implementations are complicated. But sort of the most common way it's used is that first, our web browser or other client sends a message saying, I'm connecting, here's what I support, and it sends a key share. So that public thing derived from a secret value. Then the server sends back, okay, I'm connecting, I see your connection, here's what I support, and it sends a key share. And now the server and the client can combine the key share that they received with their private information to generate a secret value that they'll use to encrypt the main part of the connection. And this is called, so this part of the connection is called the handshake. The part after it is the part that's going to use that secret value. But we aren't done yet. We have a secret value we agree on, but we haven't actually done anything in the step to know we're talking to the right server. I may have connected to google.com, but maybe that's not the server who actually sent me that key share. So I need to somehow know that. So what's going to happen is the server is going to send its certificate or a chain of certificates, so we can verify based on one of our trust anchors, oh, that's the public key of the server, and then the server is going to use its public key to sign its key share. And we're going to verify that signature, and that way we know the key share really comes from google.com and not someone else. Yeah?
So, sorry if I missed this, but for an attacker, the bottleneck for them, or the hardest point, is to guess the initial determined x and the function f, right? Like, both are kind of like hard.
So the question is, for an attacker of this, why can't the attacker look at the key share and take the place of a real server? What's going to prevent that? The hardest part. So if the attacker wants to use the key share the server actually sent, in which case the signature would be valid, then the attacker needs to undo that operation that changed the private value to that public key share, or something equivalent to undoing it. And the function will be constructed so that that's very mathematically difficult to do. If the attacker instead wants to replace this key share with one of their own, then they have to figure out how to make the signature match that the client's going to check with what's in the certificate, its public key, and that should be implausible. Question, is it possible that the attacker can guess what mathematical function they use? The attacker is expected to know that. The function is just chosen to be computationally infeasible to invert. Other questions? Yeah. Okay, so we have this key share from the server, and we have this message verifying it really comes from the right server. If we don't have that, it could come from anywhere. And then we have some final messages where we just verify that everyone agreed to the same keys. So we make a key from the key shares, combining our key share and our private data, and we say, we verify that based on that key, we all both have the same messages for the handshake, so that we both have the same certificate sent that everyone expected, so everyone's on the same page. And the server sends a message verifying that in the other direction. And at this point, the client and server know that they both have the same key made from the key shares kind of put together, and they continue the rest of the connection using symmetric encryption and authentication. So that's, and the rest of the connection, they actually use separate keys in each direction because that gets rid of attacks of like, what if you copy the message the client sent to the server going backwards? Not possible because they're different encryption keys and different map keys. Okay, some questions. Our handshake and what happens immediately after. Okay, so this is TLS does, and so what this gives us overall is we have our confidentiality and authenticity that the server, we verified, matches the certificate. The client has to be the same one that sent that initial key share, and we verify that the client was actually the one that sent all the handshake messages by verifying all the handshake messages match. We have this property of forward secrecy that I mentioned was a big reason why they've chosen to use this kind of key agreement protocol rather than just encrypting a shared secret, which is that the key shares and the corresponding private data can be temporary. So that means if you compromise a server now, connections made, a while back, you won't be able to decrypt based on that. And connections made in the future, if it becomes uncompromised, you won't be able to decrypt based on that. And also, it's fast. So most of the encryption uses those symmetric ciphers, which are much faster. And also, we only have kind of one set of messages back and forth to set up the connection. So immediately, after this finished message, we can send actual data. Whereas many other schemes might send a bunch more messages back and forth, which would be slower, especially if the server we're talking to is across the world. Questions? Okay, so that's where I'm going to finish up our little unit on cryptography. So we sort of talked about all these ways of basically communicating securely with this sort of mathematical tricks. We have these either or I should do this, private key. Private key the attacker doesn't have, or a shared key. We have this symmetric scheme, which we mentioned are faster, but require us to have kind of some shared data. We have these asymmetric schemes, which let us do this broadcast idea. And we also had this kind of key agreement, which was kind of a specialized schemes for just generating a shared secret key. And we had this specialized scheme for that, even though, yes, you can just do it with encryption. And we mentioned that, even though these things work, you can use them incorrectly. So we have examples of like replaying messages, repeating messages in contexts where they weren't expected. And our main defense against that is that the message should have enough context that that's not possible to do. Like a number identifying where it belongs in our conversation. We talked about the idea of certificates. So a way of forwarding our public keys to have them verified by someone else. And we kind of combine them all together into this transport layer security idea, where we used asymmetric encryption to set up symmetric encryption. We used certificates to verify who we were talking to was actually who we thought we were talking to, and so on. So any questions before we move on from our network security topics? Okay, so now we're switching to something completely different. So this, I hope, is mostly review, but we're going to be talking about processors. We'll actually get back to security at the end of the semester, but we'll talk about processor security instead of network security. But to talk about process security, we're going to first talk about what processors really do. And we're going to start with our simple processor model, which I hope is kind of similar to what you saw in CSO1. I may have labeled some things a little differently than they might have been labeled in CSO1. So go through what this looks like. So I have here a program counter that's going to store via register that stores the address of the instruction we're currently running. And that program counter is used to feed a circuit that I've labeled as $i for instruction cache. And this instruction cache is going to give us the instruction that's going to contain, for example, what registers it's going to access, and any constants or registers it's going to write to, and all the things which we're going to send out to other components of this circuit. Then we have a register file that's going to have a read operation and a write operation it supports. It's going to read some registers. Those are going to be used for some sort of math, depending on what the instruction is. This could be computing an address to access. This could be doing an add or multiply the programmer asked us to do. And then we're going to get a result that's possibly going to go into our data cache, either as an address to read and or a value to write. And we also might end up with values either from the data cache or from that math that go to the register file to be written. And separately, we have to compute what instruction to run next. So I have a circuit here that adds the instruction length. Not shown is that we want to have a bunch of logic to deal with like loops, which I haven't drawn here, but that's going to need to be part of that. So conceptually, what happens when we run, say, this add instruction, our program counter is going to output 100, the address of this add instruction. Our instruction cache is going to get the register indices for registers 8 and 9, send them to the register file. The register file is going to use that to read the values of them, which in this example I'm assuming are 800 and 900 in hex. That's going to go to this math circuit, which is going to add those numbers together to get a result. It's going to send those to the register file. The register file is going to figure out how to write those values. And that's going to be our cycle of executing that instruction. And at the same time, we have to prepare for the next instruction. So we're going to do that by computing where the next instruction is. In this case, we get this address of this move instruction. And this, in the simple model of a processor, would happen in one clock cycle. That we'd imagine we have this single clock where sort of kind of over here, we were like accessing the instruction cache, then we were reading the registers, then we were doing the math, and then we were writing back the values, right? But over the clock cycle, we do this whole operation, and we make our clock cycle long enough that that can work out. And at the same time, we also like, we compute the next instruction, we do the, the plus instruction, I'm still not readable. We do the, the plus instruction len computation, and we also write the PC. Right, that happens also in that clock cycle. And then in our next clock cycle, we repeat the process again, but for our move instruction. So we figure out, oh, we're writing to reading from register 10. We get the value out of register 10, which in this example is 1000. We do this address computation. We send that address we computed to the data cache. The data cache gives us the value in memory from that address, and we copy it into register 11. And that's going to happen over our clock cycle. We're going to read the instruction cache in the registers. We're going to do some math, and we're also going to squeeze in, sort of the data cache access somewhere in that clock cycle. So questions about our review of this simple model of a processor where we have all these components connected together, and over a clock cycle, we get a new value for our program counter and kind of run the instruction, and also compute what instruction we're running next. Okay, so something to note about kind of my timing diagram here is that most of my components in my processor are not actually very busy. That my instruction cache is only really important during a small part of this clock cycle. And that's going to be something we want to fix. And to talk about fixing it, I'm going to use an analogy. I'm going to talk about doing laundry. So let's say I have two loads of laundry to do. Here's my proposal. I'm going to start doing it, my first load of laundry, my lighter colored clothes, start at 11, I'm going to put them in the washer, wait for that to finish, put them in my apparently very fast dryer, wait for that to finish, fold them. Once that's all done, I can finally start my darker colored clothes and do that. I assume this is not how anyone here actually does laundry, if you have two loads to do. What should I be doing instead? Yeah?
Back-to-back.
Back-to-back. What do you mean by back-to-back?
Wash whites and colors, and then while the colors are being washed, you put the white clothes in the dryer, and then when you're folding the white clothes, you have your colored clothes in the dryer, and then you fold them.
Yeah. So you're saying I can overlap them. So I'm doing it back-to-back, but I'm doing, this is my back-to-back. I can actually kind of scoot this over here.
Yeah.
And start the next load while the other is working. Right, I can overlap this. And this is kind of intuitive to most people that you look at the washer, it's not doing anything. I could do something with the washer. And so we want to end up with a schedule kind of more like this. And I can do much more in that time. And we're going to kind of do a version of this strategy for a processor where we're going to make the same observation about our instruction cache. Our instruction cache isn't really doing anything most of the clock cycle. It's only doing something for a little bit of the clock cycle, just like our washer here wasn't doing something most of the time before I fixed that. Now, something you can note about this schedule here is that I actually have some time that I'm not really using for the washer, even though I've thought about my problem is the washer's not being used all the time. I'm still not using the washer all the time. And in fact, this situation is kind of too optimistic. I'm kind of assuming that my dryer is pretty fast. It's not, so it's maybe more like this. Right, my dryer's pretty slow. So I'm not actually ending up, when I do this, with full utilization of my washer. And that's because this dryer is a bottleneck for me. I have to wait for it to be free to make any progress. There's nothing really useful I can do with the washer a bunch of the time. And this also means that this scheme for doing laundry is slower in some senses. That if you're asking me to do this load of laundry as fast as possible, and this is how I'm doing loads of laundry, I'm not doing that. I am taking a little over 2 hours to do each load of laundry, whereas if I were doing it without worrying about other loads, it would take me less time. But we intuitively kind of prefer doing it in this way because we don't actually care about how long does it take to do this load of laundry. We care about how long it takes to do all our loads of laundry. And the same is going to be true with our processors. That with a processor, we don't care how long it takes to run each instruction. We actually care how long it takes to run the whole program. So we're going to implement this kind of technique in our processor, and when we do so, we're going to make each instruction slower. And we're going to be very happy about it because we're going to make the whole program a lot faster. And we're going to make each instruction slower because, like with our dryer here, we're going to have some components of our processor that just aren't fast enough to keep up with the others. And that's just how it's going to be. That's still going to be fine because we're going to be getting a lot more work at once. So questions about this idea? Yes? What's this red hash part? That's the time when the washer is not in use, even though washer's not in use because, we're waiting for to put this in the dryer.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. So there's nothing useful we can really do right now.
So that's the dark gray is something else running.
The dark gray is something else running, yes. So from our previous, it's like the previous load using the dryer.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So the question is, there are cases where you decide to get rid of this waste of time and prioritize something. So obviously in the laundry scenario, we can do that. Processors that are implementing this technique, I guess you could do that. I haven't heard of any doing that because it's very rarely makes sense. And if you think of why, we're talking about running instructions. Instructions typically take, nanoseconds at most to run when they don't have a cache miss or something, and that's going to be, not going to be really noticeable as far as overall program performance generally. We're going to talk later about some techniques that are more than pipelining, which might achieve some of the same goals you have there, and the basic idea for how we do that is that we just run parts of two instructions kind of independently, and that would probably be how we achieve that kind of goal. So we run the instruction you want to be fast on a separate piece of hardware from the other stuff. It would be a way a real processor might do something that achieves the same kind of goal you have. Other questions? Okay, so talked about our laundry scenario here, and I've labeled this time as latency. So we're going to talk about two terms for measuring time. One is latency, and by latency I mean the time from start to finish. So how long from when we start an instruction until when that instruction is done, or how long until when we start a load of laundry until when it's done. And I have labeled here as the time to do one thing, beginning to end. And as I mentioned, this is usually not what we care about. In fact, by doing this idea of overlapping our operations, we are increasing the latency. And the reason we're okay with that is the time we actually care about is what we'll call the throughput, sort of the rate for doing lots of things. And there's a bunch of ways we can measure the throughput. So one way is we can look how long is it between when we finish each load of laundry in this case. And I can do a calculation, I can say, oh, that's 1.2 loads of laundry per hour. I can also measure that by measuring how long it is between when we start loads of laundry. And it turns out that these numbers are the same. And that's not a coincidence. When we have this pipeline, we're kind of limited by the slowest thing, which is our dryer in this case. And basically, every time our dryer finishes one load, then everything can advance. So it turns out everything is sort of working in lockstep. And if we look anywhere in the pipeline, we'll see the same rate of progressing to the next step. Anywhere in these steps for doing the load of laundry, or later on in the process, or anywhere in the steps for doing an instruction. Everything will be sort of advancing from one step to the next all at the same time. And how fast they can do that is going to be based on whatever step is slowest. Because everything before that step needs to wait for it to be free. Everything after that step needs to wait for the step to give it something to do. Questions? Our throughput computation. Yes?
And so, in practice, trying to do this, like trying to have this lockstep, would that add additional time to the process if you had to do the bookkeeping to maintain this like lockstep?
So the question, is there going to be some overhead for bookkeeping? Right here, I'm just kind of showing we finished a load on the dryer and it goes right to the folding table instantaneously. Yes, there's going to be a bookkeeping overhead we will talk about very explicitly. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I've talked about this idea which we're going to call pipelining, kind of dividing it up into steps, doing steps for different instructions at the same time. We're going to look at how we implement that in our processor. And I'm going to talk about one way we can modify the simple processor to support doing the instructions in these steps. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to divide up the processor into pieces. And I've highlighted the pieces I'm going to choose, and they have names that are conventional if you look up designs for processors. Some of these names, while they're conventional and we'll use them, maybe are not the names that should have been chosen. So our names are going to be fetch. That makes sense. That's where we read instructions from the instruction cache. Decode, which you would think is where we do all the instruction processing, is something we're going to do in the decode stage typically, but also it's where we read registers. Then we have our execute stage, is where we do the actual math. The memory stage, where we do a data cache access. And the write back stage where we deal with writing. And something you might complain about is I have this memory box here, and most of our instructions don't use that data cache. They don't do anything with it. So couldn't I like get rid of that sometimes? And the answer is we're not going to do that. We're going to always have that stage be there, and often it will have do nothing. And you might say, couldn't we save some time by skipping it? Well, maybe, but not really, because once one instruction uses it, everyone has to wait behind it. So in practice, we're not going to ever skip it. We're just going to always do it, and sometimes what an instruction needs to do in it is going to be nothing. But we have to have it there because, you know, we're going to pay for the cost of it because we sometimes use it. Now, we have these sort of separate stages. And one idea you might have is, okay, well, we want to do multiple instructions in a clock cycle, so let's just, you know, start one instruction at the beginning of our clock cycle, start one a fifth of the way in, another the fifth, two-fifths of the way in, and so on. And that doesn't really work. And a big reason that doesn't work is that once we change what we're giving to the instruction cache, these outputs will change, and the reading circuitry in the register file kind of needs to have the register number not be changing. It needs to know what register we're reading from. We can't just tell it 9 and then start telling it 10 and expect it to know to read register 9 because that was for the first instruction. So we're going to need some place to store the values that each of these steps need to work on while the previous step is working on something new. And that means we need some storage component, and what hopefully comes to mind is, well, we have a storage component here. It's a register. We can use more of those. So we'll install some registers, which we'll call pipeline registers, in between the steps, which we'll call stages. And we'll basically have these registers hold all the values that the thing in front of it is working on, and we'll update all the values for all the pipeline registers in lockstep when everything moves from one step to the next. Yeah?
Are these essentially like the barriers that you're using for threads? Like, do they operate in the same way?
Do these operate in the same way as the barriers? So they operate in the same way as like everyone syncs up in these pipeline registers. As for how we're gonna make that happen, it's not gonna be the same. So like with barriers and B-threads, right, the barrier detects when everyone's gotten there. Here, what we're gonna do is we're gonna set a clock cycle, and we're gonna compute the cycle time based on the worst case for any stage, and if we don't do that computational correctly, well, our processor's not gonna work. Okay. Questions? Yes. Is it always this many stages? No. I would say having stages that look kind of like these is very common, but yes, it's definitely lots of variation in the number of stages real processors have used, especially since we'll talk about some more advanced processor designs that have some extra things we want to do later on. I would say in practice, like, you know, there are real processors that are single cycle, they're not very common, and then you get from like 5 to like 20 at the very high end for general purpose processors, and I've heard of specialized processors with like 100 pipeline stages, but they're probably organized very differently. Other questions? Okay. So now that we have this set up here, let's talk about how instructions run in this. So I'm going to have 3 instructions here, and I could have marked out our timeline that, like with our laundry scenario, we're going to have our first instruction, our first load of laundry, go through the first component, which is our fetch stage in this case. And in this case, we're going to read the add instruction, and we're going to get register number 8 and 9 out. And we're going to store that 8 and 9 in that first pipeline register. So then, in the next cycle, we're going to start using the register read machinery. We're done with the fetch stuff. And that means the next instruction can use the fetch. So we're going to have the next instruction fetch this move here. And at the same time, we're going to take our decode stage and have it read the registers for that first add instruction. So we're doing the second step of the add instruction while we're doing the first step of the move instruction. And our pipeline register is storing the register indices for the add instruction, so the second step knows what to do. And it's important that we store that because what the instruction cache is doing is definitely nothing to do with the add instruction anymore. So we'll read those registers. So we have our move instruction being fetched, and just ahead of it, our add instruction is doing the decode, the register read operation. Then, once we read the registers and we fetch the move instruction, we're gonna be passing the register to read for the move instruction. The move instruction is gonna advance from fetch to decode. We're gonna be adding values for add instruction since we just read the register values. And we're also going to be fetching this XOR instruction. And to make this happen, we have 10 here stored in the pipeline registers between fetch and decode. We have this 800 and 900 stored in the registers between decode and execute. So those steps know what to do. And we're going to have our fetch stage here reading the XOR instruction to get register numbers 12 and 13. That is an XOR instruction. Then in the next cycle, our add instruction will advance to our memory stage, and it will just pass through the value that we computed in the previous stage. We don't have any work to do in the memory stage. That doesn't mean we're skipping it. We're just going to pass through the value. We're not doing much work, but we're still going to take a full cycle because we have to wait for everyone else. Our execute stage is going to do the address computation for this move, using values that are stored in the decode to execute registers. And our decode stage is going to read the registers for the XOR. Then in our next cycle, our add is going to have the sum actually written to the register file, while our move actually uses its memory stage to read from the data cache while we're doing an XOR for the XOR instruction. And I didn't show it here, but presumably there's an instruction in the fetch and decode from further on in this program. So we are doing 5 different instructions all at the same time, just different pieces of them. And as this goes on, our memory instruction in the next cycle will advance to write back and write back whatever we read from memory. Our execute instruction will pass, will at the same time pass through the XOR value, and so on. Some questions about the execution in this pipeline? Yeah?
So if one instruction was just ran alone, it would take 5 cycles to complete?
Question, if one instruction was ran alone, it would take 5 cycles to complete? Yes. Now, presumably, as we'll mention when we talk probably next time, like the cycle time is going to be much shorter for this new processor here than the one that ran one instruction per cycle. So the instruction that takes 5 cycles to complete will probably be slower, but it won't be that much slower as far as latency goes. Other questions? Yeah.
So do these like clock speed calculations change per clock speed?
Do these clock speed calculations change per clock?
Per, I guess, each cycle of FDE, FW, like, would you recalculate, once it's all passed through, like, I guess, when does the clock speed change to be the maximum of new data coming in?
Question, when does the clock speed change? So usually, we're not going to set the clock speed based on what instructions are running. That is technically possible to do. I'm not aware of any sort of commercial processors that do that. Commercial processors do have variable clock speed, but it varies for other reasons, like whether the processor is too hot to dissipate the heat. It does not vary based on one instruction. So we will set the clock speed based on kind of the worst case and leave it there. And let's do this. So I have our processor here. Let's say our cycle time is 500 picoseconds. What's the latency of an instruction? So who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Good, we have consensus. That's because it seems we have consensus, or at least or something, close to consensus. So we have 4 or 5 cycles to run the instruction from beginning to end. What is our overall throughput? So thanks A, B, C, D, no clue, something else. Okay, so once we got this started, every cycle, we're completing one instruction. Alternately, every cycle, we're starting a new instruction. So our throughput is actually going to be here one every one cycle, one every 500 picoseconds. So that's where I'll leave off today. So next time we'll talk about like what affects the cycle time and also some issues we may have glossed over with like, what about a conditional jump? How does that work?